Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson, and in this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to Jeffrey Keating, a very highly regarded B2B content marketer who's led the charge on content marketing at Intercom for nearly 4 years now, where he's had a hand in everything from content creation to editing, producing ebooks, putting together podcasts, white papers, email marketing campaigns, and more. Based out of Dublin, Ireland, Jeffrey originally studied history and philosophy when he went through university, a helpful nudge that he got from his parents who encouraged him to treat his school experience as learning more about the subjects he found deeply interesting rather than just a roadmap to choosing a career. After finishing up his studies, Jeffrey started working pretty much immediately with editing content at a couple of different digital agencies before making his way to Intercom. In this episode, Jeffrey and I talk about how he and his content team strategically built an authoritative brand and grew the Intercom blog from 50,000 to now over 150,000 monthly visitors. We strategize on breaking down the number one traffic driving strategy that's working best for the Intercom marketing team today. We dig into the single best piece of career advice Jeffrey wants to share with every marketer and, seriously, so much more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Jeffrey Keating. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I'm always excited when I get to chat with another content marketer, especially someone like yourself who's been at the helm of a pretty iconic startup blog for quite a while now. But before we get ahead of ourselves here, I do want to start at the beginning with you. Where are you originally from?
I'm from Dublin, so I've lived here all my life. Don't see myself moving anytime soon, so very blessed to have lived very, very close to where I grew up as well. So I bought a house last year about 1 kilometer from my parents' house, as sad as that sounds.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. I don't think there's anything sad about that. Family's important. I love it. So did you go to school also in Dublin?
I did, yeah. So I went to school and university. So I studied English and history in university, then went on to do a master's in history as well. I was studying at the time of, or I graduated at the time of an extremely bad recession in Ireland, actually. So I was pretty dead set on going into full-blown academia, obviously went away and did my master's, was on the cusp of about to start a PhD again in history because I was presuming that the only options available to me were down the sort of hardcore academic route. But I decided, given that I'd been, you know, in full-time education there for, you know, nigh on about 10 or 11 years, just take a year out and reassess things, maybe do some traveling. But thankfully enough, I actually found a job in a film production studio, and kind of the rest is history. I've kind of been working ever since. So I'm glad I never pursued that academic career, I have to say.
Well, you know, I think it's really interesting because I've had a lot of people on the show who have had very diverse areas of study. It seems like philosophy is actually a pretty common one, and then go on to be in content or, you know, broader business fields. But I think this is really interesting. What made you choose the career path, or rather the field of study, history and philosophy at first?
So I think my parents would be big believers in sort of the liberal arts, and in general, taking the sort of 4 years that you're given to study and not necessarily tying it to a particular career path. So when I actually went into university, I was kind of dead set on a very sort of strict university program that would, you know, ultimately deliver me a job straight after. So whether that would be business, whether that be economics, whether that would be law. So they were kind of like my top, you know, rated sort of fields that I was kind of like eyeing up when I was finishing school. My parents were big believers in the fact that you'll never get this opportunity again to have 4 years of your life that you basically just don't have to consider work at all. And ultimately, I think they're just kind of believers in the fact that ultimately, you know, your career will be so much different from the actual field of study that you've ever engaged in. So just to take the opportunity to study something that you're kind of passionate about. And, you know, history, philosophy, English, you know, classical literature was always something that I was interested in as well. So again, I kind of, you know, took them at face value and decided to actually pursue that. Now, ultimately, as I said, graduating the time I did in an extremely bad recession in Ireland, ultimately, I'm not sure if it was the best choice. But, you know, I'm pretty happy where I ended up. And I was just, you know, grateful for the 4 years of actually being able to just read and, you know, just get a good grounding in sort of critical theory, which, again, I think has stood to me.
Right. And I think also the additional context of now zooming out and looking at your life, right? Like we're on almost 10 years later, maybe, as kind of a round number. That experience, I'm sure, is something that'll stick around with you as something that was very worthwhile. And this is really awesome. I love that sort of ability to think about your studying time at university as something that'll benefit you for your entire life. And it wasn't that I didn't have supportive parents, because I did have supportive parents, but at the same time, I feel like university in the US is viewed as like job prep, career prep versus, say, you know, creating a well-run.
And again, I have to say, I think that is normal given the sort of university structure in the US where you are graduating with, you know, X amount of debt. Again, feel very privileged for the fact that in Ireland, universities are actually free. Schools are largely free as well. So you do have, I know that I said I graduated at not a particularly good time economically, but you're at least graduating liberated from any sort of like significant student debt. So you can actually, you know, start your life going forward. So definitely empathize with the fact that in the US, you know, if I would the shoes were on a different foot, I would definitely would be, you know, considering choosing something that would be, you know, closely tied to a job itself. So I feel very privileged to actually had a free university as well. So.
Oh, yes. Very. So let's talk about after school now. So, you know, you mentioned, you alluded to what your first job was doing. It seems like pretty much immediately after graduating, you kind of jump into a content related role. What was that first job?
So once I graduated, I was lucky enough to get a job in a kind of film production house, post-production house. And initially my job there, again, was loosely tied to my degree, actually, or at least complementary. So I was working on a lot of like archival footage. So restoring old archival footage from, you know, the early 20th century in Ireland. So again, a very sort of like interest, like, you know, I was sitting there all day sort of like manually restoring this footage. Again, incredible access to this archival material that I had. But actually what ended up happening is that role ended up transitioning into looking after their sort of web properties again, because they were a post-production house and they obviously sold their services globally. So again, there's a lot of content going on their website. And I think at the time, so that was probably, you know, 2010 probably. And again, I was kind of like, oh, okay, so manually updating websites and like updating, copying websites, that's probably going to be a job like for time immemorial going forward. So I was like, oh, actually, as opposed to, you know, restoring archival footage, which, you know, let's be real, I'm not sure how long, much longer that might be around or how sort of, how many job opportunities might flow out of that in terms of, you know, updating, you know, website copy or just writing content for the internet. You know, on the flip side of that, I saw that a kind of booming industry. So, you know, I pretty much like made a decision there that was like, actually, I think this is a pretty, you know, fruitful career path to follow. And then from there, just lucky enough to get to know like a lot of the people that worked there, which ultimately led to my next role, which was in a sort of UX/content design agency. And from there, you know, again, made connections, which kind of led to Intercom. So I think ultimately, as I kind of reflect my career again, it's only through the people that I've got to know that I've kind of led to where I am. So again, I think that's just, there's always this sort of sense, you know, people talk about like the PayPal mafia. We talk about the sort of like Intercom mafia as well when we leave Intercom, that, you know, these connections that you kind of carry through with you throughout your career are just super important. And I'm a big believer in that, just of, just, you know, staying friendly with people I know and just, you know, keeping your ear to the ground for other opportunities.
Yeah, very true. That's a trend that I've seen with, I think it's probably especially true in the startup space, right? Like people are always kind of, you know, average job tenure is between 1 and 2 years. People are hopping around to the next thing. Everyone knows everyone else or do so through mutual connections. But I think that goes to show that your reputation and the, you know, genuine authenticity of the relationships you build is extremely important in any career path.
For sure.
I love it. So after, you know, leaving this agency, you joined Intercom. This takes us up to 2015. What was it like at Intercom at this point in time? They were still a relatively young startup, right?
Yeah, so I joined when it was around about 100 people. So currently we are at around 650. So a super, super exciting time to join. Obviously, I'd known Intercom quite well in terms of like European startups. They're, you know, one of the most successful. I also knew a lot of people who had worked at Intercom previously. A lot of people from my previous company had joined as well. So it was a kind of like a well-worn path, and I knew that they've been very successful as well. So again, when I was, you know, given the opportunity, I kind of jumped straight at it. So in terms of like what it was like back then, very scrappy, very organic. The marketing team was like super small at that stage. I think it was about 7 people on the marketing team. Now we're kind of 65. And in terms of, you know, the content team specifically, so my current boss, John, who's a director of content, was there. And the culture of content in general really, even at that stage, kind of permeated the company. Des and Owen, who are the founders, had really done a really good job just on their own bat of, you know, using content to kind of build their brand. And now a lot of that was kind of shouldered by themselves. You know, Des, again, pretty incredible for a co-founder, had written like 93 of the first 100 blog posts that Intercom had ever published, which, again, when you think of the
it's impressive
demands on a co-founder's time, you know, writing blog posts is not one that he usually devotes significant amount of attention to. But I think that just illustrates the priority that content was kind of given. So once John and once myself and once, you know, we started to build the team out, it kind of only accelerated even further. And I think a lot of what is kind of different from now, from back in the day, is like the product itself was like relatively simple. The personas that we kind of went after were relatively simple as well. It was ostensibly a tool that, you know, for product managers to get, you know, feedback on their products through in-app messaging. And now the kind of surface area of the product has sort of grown exponentially. Now we have products for sales, for marketing, for support, obviously for product managers as well, which again has kind of added to the kind of complexity and scope of all of our roles as well, because what used to be a sort of simple publication that spoke to, you know, people who were maybe product managers or CEOs or founders, now we have a content strategy that has to cater to multiple different personas and multiple different audiences. So it was a lot simpler back then. It was also a lot more complex because we had, you know, limited bandwidth, we had limited documentation, limited processes. And it's just been an amazing journey so far, and feel grateful to have been here.
What kinds of goals and metrics mattered most, say, you know, closer to those earlier days when you guys were still a pretty small marketing team? Did you have like a, you know, a weekly publishing target? Did you have a weekly, you know, traffic target, email subscriber target? Like, what were kind of the more important marketing metrics at the time?
Sure. So the way I like to think about this is, I think this is probably mirrors the experience of many early stage startups as well, is that in the very early days, like, you're just fighting for brand awareness. You're just fighting for people to know your name. So very, very much, you know, I'm a big believer that content marketing is a very effective, you know, customer acquisition channel. That said, when we started, that was absolutely not the goal. It was to ensure that people knew about Intercom, knew about its product offerings, and then by virtue of hearing about us, building that currency, building that sort of like brand awareness, that if they ever needed a product like Intercom, we'd be top of mind. But we're very, very much not trying to attribute content to revenue at that stage. All of the content we published was entirely top of the funnel. Now, again, that's evolved massively over, you know, the past 4 years as we become a bit more dialed into sort of wider marketing metrics, as we become a bit more laser targeted on exactly who we were selling to. We definitely try and attribute content towards revenue a little bit more. Now, it's not easy. In general, I think revenue growth from content is kind of like a lagging indicator of success. Mm-hmm. In general, you know, readers aren't going to be ready to buy immediately. That said, you know, we now currently, whereas we didn't have in the early days, you know, a couple of ways to validate the ROI of content. So
I love that. That seems like something that only comes with a certain level of maturity and scale also, being able to consistently and reliably tie content to some sort of revenue metric at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And I mean, a lot of this is kind of knowing that you have a sort of like established base of historical data to work with. You know, I mean, it's just impossible if you're just starting out. And I think this is often in some ways why content marketing I'm not going to say fails or why people kind of give up on content marketing is because it's very, very hard to establish. As I said, it's a lagging indicator of success. So a lot of people maybe like start publications or start a podcast and they're not seeing that like immediate sort of conversion rate and they're not seeing any revenue coming from it. So they're like, okay, well, I invested all this money, invested in all this time, and I'm not seeing the success yet. Like content marketing in general is a very, very long game and you really have to invest the time and kind of stick with it before you actually see any measurable results, in my experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Strap in, put your seatbelt on. It's going to take a few years.
Absolutely.
So if you can remember back to, you know, what things looked like around when you first started, let's say, you know, 2015-ish, about how much traffic was the Intercom blog generating back then?
So I would say when I joined, probably in the region of, I'm going to say about like 50,000 page views per month. Again, I probably have to like double check that. But I mean, that was what was kind of like baked into our sort of like goals and metrics at the time that we were working towards. Now, our metrics in some ways were kind of skewed because we actually had some incredible like standout hits. So we had one post called, one article by our VP of product called Paul Adams. It was called The End of Apps, which again, just when gangbusters, it got around like 350,000 page views, which again is just like absolutely incredible. So that definitely like skewed our metrics a little bit. But I think, you know, around 50,000 page views per month is what we were kind of like committing to the business anyway. So,
and how about today? What kind of growth have you guys seen over the 4 or so years you've been there?
So currently we are in the region of about 120 to 150,000 page views per month. Again, we are usually in the region of, let's say 1.5 million per, you know, financial year is what we kind of like aim towards. Again, that's kind of like one metric that we track. There's obviously a different metric, which is kind of, there's kind of a split in our team. Again, it's not a very organized split and it's not something that we communicate widely, but there's kind of two metrics that we were accountable for, and that's kind of how we organize ourselves. So the first one is traffic, and the second one is obviously email addresses and MQLs. And again, that's kind of more for like our gated content. So they're kind of the two metrics that we kind of report back up to the business. In terms of, yeah, in terms of traffic, would be kind of 1.2 or 1.5 million that would be aiming towards for a calendar year.
Yeah, that's pretty significant. That's a big, big content business. And especially given that you guys have a lot of stuff that's kind of very tailored to specific personas and then it leads to pathways. I mean, you guys are very thoughtful about your content strategy from what I've seen. It kind of like launches people from, you know, blog posts to, or from blog posts to very specific, you know, resource download or something else that kind of like leads into a product tie-in. It's very, very thoughtful from my outward observations.
Yeah, again, that's something that's probably we've become a bit more dialed into over the, I would say probably like 18 months or 2 years, just to make sure that like one of the best parts of actually working at Intercom is that we have a very, very well-stocked library of content. So for anything we publish, there's an accompanying offer to go with it. Again, ideally that accompanying offer is gated as well. That, you know, gives us a bit of like ROI for the blog post that we publish. But again, like our big belief is that there should always be a next step for someone. There should always be, you know, there's this great, I think it's Brian Balfour actually of Reforge has this concept of kind of like viral loops. We're big believers in that. So like once we get someone into one of our content properties is that they can just keep snacking, keep consuming content over and over again. And again, that's a byproduct of us having such a well-stocked library at our disposal.
Yeah, takes time to build. So Jeffrey, one thing that I've come to notice, both on my own blog and with the different kinds of clients I've worked with over the years, is that there's usually kind of an 80-20 rule at play in terms of which articles are driving traffic, meaning that about, you know, say 20% of content drives 80% of the traffic. Do you guys see this as well on the Intercom blog?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's, I think one of our kind of core tenets of our team, and it's something that, you know, our boss sort of and director, John, has kind of drilled into us and the company in general, is that this concept of kind of like evergreen content. And I think what we mean by that is kind of that the content that we like to produce is content that kind of addresses, you know, really, really timeless themes. And I would say kind of answers the kind of recurring questions that people generally will always have. It kind of takes a broad perspective on topics, and it really, maybe compared to like news publications, really focuses on like enduring ideas and advice that we like to think will have currency for, you know, months and kind of years going forward. So we invest pretty heavily in evergreen content to ensure that, you know, we get maximum bang for our buck in what we publish. Now that said, we still publish a lot of content, support things like, I'm not going to say temporal content, but more to support like temporal events, such as like product launches or, you know, like new books or, you know, new features. Again, that sort of stuff that in general we see is not stuff that has a very long tail. There's kind of a kind of immediate spike post-publication, but generally what you'll see is that it kind of quickly flatlines after. We invest a lot of time into evergreen content that we know will kind of have like peaks and troughs over sort of the coming months and coming years. So that's kind of like a big sort of like tenant of our content strategy and of like our editorial team is very much, okay, if we publish something, how can we pull out the sort of like universal aspect of this to make sure that it's relevant, you know, over the coming months and years.
I like that. It's a really smart focus. And I like they use the word investment quite a lot in there too, because it really is an investment. It takes time for it to pay off. If it even eventually pays off, right? Like you have to put a lot of work into promoting the content in order to get there.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's something that I think we've become a bit more dialed into as well over the, you know, last sort of like 24 months, because we were pretty lucky insofar as like when I joined Intercom anyway, we had a really, really established audience of like product managers and CEOs and designers, and we had a really good reputation. It meant that a lot of people were coming like inbound to our, you know, blog and associated properties. Like it was a good community built around Intercom and, you know, its audience. As I kind of alluded to earlier, as a sort of product canvas has grown and like our audience has kind of shifted into different areas, we've really had to focus a lot more on distribution because, you know, salespeople weren't naturally coming to Intercom and marketers maybe weren't naturally coming to Intercom as well. And the big thing I've learned there is not necessarily to, you know, publish and just kind of turn your back and, you know, hope that, you know, some marketer or salesperson will kind of find their way here. Very much about trying to, you know, find the audience and find out where they linger. So for example, for sales folk, it's mostly like LinkedIn. For marketers, it might be like, you know, Growth Hackers or, you know, Inbound when it was still around. So it's like finding these communities where they linger and kind of reverse engineering your content from there. So for example, like when we launched our sales product that was last year, of course we could have just like deployed our, you know, tried and test tactics. We could have just published blog posts and, you know, books and podcasts, you know, ad nauseum and tried to kind of like, you know, push it to that audience. But what we had to do is kind of like figure out, okay, well, where are these people? You know, and ultimately we found that they were on LinkedIn. And then kind of like reverse engineer not only just like what types of content they're interested in, but also the kind of like mediums, like what is the best way to actually, you know, reach sales folk. Mm-hmm. And what we found out is that like sales folk in general, like don't like consuming long form content. They're very much sort of like driven towards, you know, short, snappy, like hard claims. That's kind of interesting, like kind of no bullshit. So ultimately what we actually decided to do is kind of like a video campaign on LinkedIn, because that ultimately was the most digestible medium for sales folks. So again, I think that's kind of just ultimately, we're very much more distribution focused than we were maybe 24 months ago. And in some way, we kind of had to be distribution first and then content second as well, because we're kind of like, you know, ultimately we have to understand where these people are before we can actually create content for them. So.
Yeah. And I love that example you shared too of the, you know, video campaigns for salespeople on LinkedIn. That's so specific. But I think the takeaway for everyone that wants to create content and actually reach an audience is that you have to create content in a medium that your, you know, your target audience wants to consume it in, right? Like it, you could create tons of long form articles and try and shove it down the throats of salespeople. But, you know, if your average time on page is 10 seconds because they're not finding a quick answer, it's kind of a failure.
Yeah, and I think for us, and again, I'm just a big believer, like in general, like when we have like a brainstorm or we're generating ideas or, you know, someone even pitches idea to us, like in general, I'm kind of format agnostic, you know, and I think the best content marketers, they're really those people who are, you know, willing to help you kind of figure out what you're trying to say and then how to say it and then the best, you know, medium to actually reach these people at. They're not necessarily people who are like wedded to an immediate, to a specific channel or a specific format in advance. And I think for us as a team, it's kind of when, you know, we have a particular idea, like that idea might manifest itself as like, you know, three lines of blog post. It might be three pages. It might not be a blog post at all. It might be a microsite. It can take all different forms. Everything is kind of on the table. And for us, it's kind of like the format, like the form that it takes doesn't really matter. It's kind of the stories and making sure that it kind of resonates with that specific audience. Ultimately, that, you know, for us matters the most.
That's genius. I like that approach. It doesn't assume that you immediately know the best possible answer for every, you know, consumer of your content.
Absolutely. And I think there's kind of like a marketing channel fit there. It's kind of, you can't necessarily like railroad a specific content format for people who are just like not optimized to consume said format. So for example, again, I can think of the start of this year, we launched a new podcast season called Scale. Again, was very much kind of targeting, you know, CMOs and VPs of sales, again, who was a target audience for that particular quarter for us. So again, there's probably a lot of ways that we could have tried to reach that audience. You know, we could have had like a social campaign, we could have had blog posts, but from what we heard from talking to our own VPs of sales and our own CMO was kind of like, you know, these are very busy people. They need a very consumable format, and podcast was the medium that they were most, they consumed most. So again, that kind of led us, okay, well, actually, this has to be a podcast season. It can't be sort of a long form blog format because that's just not something that's going to resonate with that particular audience. So again, you know, I think ultimately it's just kind of like understand the audience first and then sort of like retrofit and sort of like reverse engineer your ideas from there. So
I love it. All right. Well, Jeffrey, the last question I have for you, sure. What's been the best investment you feel you've ever made in the context of growing your career as a marketer? This could be in the form of time, money, tools, products, services, or otherwise.
God. Okay. Give me a second to think about that one. That's a good question. I think the best piece of career advice that I've kind of learned as a marketer over, you know, the past, you know, 10 years is that, and this specifically relates to content marketing, is that you really have to earn the right to sell. And I'm on calls like every week with, you know, different content marketers, different marketers in the industry. And they're all looking, okay, so how can we, you know, measure the ROI of our content? And, you know, how can we generate leads? How can we generate MQLs? And these are, a lot of these people are kind of like early stage companies as well. And I think the success of Intercom and how we built our brand is, we really invested time in building a community and earning the right to sell so that when we actually had to convert people, they were exponentially more likely to build in, to buy Intercom because we'd invested time in building that relationship. I do think that if we had come kind of straight out of the gate with, you know, gated content and just tried to convert people straight away, there's no way we would have had the success that we've seen. So I think ultimately what I've learned as a marketer is like you really have to invest time in being authentic and invest in the relationship with your readership, because ultimately otherwise, I think the whole facade of marketing kind of falls down otherwise. I think there has to be a fair value exchange. I think you have to invest time in kind of building that relationship. And ultimately, if you do that, I think you'll be successful. So I think that's ultimately what I've learned over the, you know, the last 10 years, I'd say.
I love it. And I think without even realizing it, you just brought us full circle from where we started this conversation. The value of your relationships is everything.
Yeah. And just like we've had fantastic success with, you know, our books and our gated contents. We have 11 books and, you know, about 15 guides, but the value exchange has to be fair. Someone has to, you know, believe that what they're giving you an email address for is actually, you know, worth what they're getting on the other side. If you just like, you know, try and put up like a, you know, shitty white paper or something that, you know, is clearly like not going to give any sort of like meaningful value to the end user, any subsequent nurture campaign or any subsequent attempt to actually convert that person is just not going to be successful. So there has to be a sort of like value symmetry between, you know, the reader and the content producer. So that's something that I'm a general believer in and something that, up until this point, I think it's been successful for Intercom. So,
I love it. Great advice. All right. Well, Jeffrey, thank you for joining us. Can you tell everyone listening where they can go to learn more about you, Intercom, and everything you guys are up to?
So you can follow me, just Jeffrey Keating on Twitter, intercom.com/blog. You know, you'll find me on LinkedIn as well. I'm happy to chat on any of those mediums, or drop me a mail, jeffrey@intercom.io.
Beautiful. Thank you again for joining us.
Great. Thanks so much, Ryan.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.